You could hang there all weekend. In Dartford in those days, and maybe still, you turned one way to the west, and there was the city. But if you went east or south, you got deep country. You were aware you were right at the very edge. In those days, Dartford was a real peripheral suburb. It also had its own character, still does. It didn't feel part of London. You didn't feel that you were a Londoner. I can't quite remember any civic pride in Dartford when I was growing up. It was something to get out of. I didn't feel any nostalgia when I went back that day, except for one thing. The smell of the heath. That brought back more memories than anything else. I love the air of Sussex, where I live, to death. But there's a certain mixture of stuff on Dartford Heath, a unique smell of gorse and heather, that I don't get anywhere else. The glory bumps had gone, or were grown over, or weren't as big as I thought they were. But walking through that bracken took me back. London, to me, when I grew up, was horseshit and coal smoke. For 5 or 6 years after the war, there was more horse-drawn traffic in London than there was after the First World War. It was a pungent mixture, which I really miss. It was a sort of bed you lay in, sensory-wise. I'm going to try and market it for the older citizens. Remember this? London Pong. London hasn't changed that much to me, except for the smell. And the fact that you can now see how beautiful some of the buildings are, like the Natural History Museum, with the grime cleaned off and the blue tiles. Nothing looked like that then. The other thing was that the street belonged to you. I remember later on seeing pictures of Chichester High Street in the 1900s, and the only things in the street are kids playing ball and a horse and cart coming down the road. You just got out of the way for the occasional vehicle. When I was growing up, it was heavy fog almost all winter, and if you've got 2 or 3 miles to walk to get back home, it was the dogs that led you. Suddenly old Dodger would show up with a patch on his eye, and you could basically guide your way home by that. Sometimes the fog was so thick, you couldn't see a thing, and old Dodger would take you up and hand you over to some Labrador. Animals were in the street, something that's disappeared. I would have got lost and died without some help from my canine friends. When I was 9, they gave us a council house in Temple Hill, in a wasteland. I was much happier in Chistillion Road. But Doris considered we were very lucky. We've got a house, and all of that crap. Okay, so you drag your ass to the other side of town. There was, of course, a serious housing crisis for a few years after the war. In Dartford, many people were living in prefabs in Prince's Road. Charlie Watts was still living in a prefab house when I first met him in 1962. A whole section of the population had put down roots in these asbestos and tin roof buildings, lovingly cared for them. There wasn't much the British government could do after the war except try and clean up the mess, which you were part of. They glorified themselves in the process, of course. They called the streets of this new estate after themselves, the Labour Party elite, past and present. A little hastily in the latter category, maybe, given that they had been in power only 6 years before they were out again. They saw themselves as heroes of a working-class struggle, one of whose militants and party faithful was my own granddad, Ernie Richards, who had, with my grandmother Eliza, more or less created the Walthamstow Labour Party. The estate had been opened in 1947 by Clement Attlee, the post-war prime minister and Ernie's friend, one of those who had a street named after him. His speech is preserved in the ether. We want people to have places they will love, places in which they will be happy, and where they will form a community and have a social life and a civic life. Here in Dartford, you are setting an example of how this should be done. No, it wasn't nice, Doris would say. It was rough. It's a lot rougher now. Parts of Temple Hill are no-go areas. Real youth gang hell. It was still under construction when we moved in. There was a building shed on the corner, no trees, armies of rats. It looked like a moonscape. And even though it was 10 minutes from the Dartford that I knew, the old Dartford, it sort of made me feel for a while, at that age, that I'd been transported to some sort of alien territory. I felt like I'd been moved to some other planet for at least a year or so before I could get to know a neighbor. But Mum and Dad loved the council house. I had no choice but to bite my tongue. As a semi-detached goes, it was new, and it was well-built, but it wasn't ours. I thought we deserved better, and it made me bitter. I thought of us as a noble family in exile, pretentious, and I sometimes despised my parents for accepting their fate. That was then. I had no concept of what they'd been through. Mick and I knew each other just because we happened to live very close, just a few doors away, with a bit of schooling thrown in. But then once we moved away from near my school to the other side of town, I became across the tracks. You don't see anybody. You're not there. Mick had moved from Denver Road to Wilmington, a very nice suburb of Dartford, whereas I'm totally across town, across the tracks. The railway literally goes right through the center of town. Temple Hill. The name was a bit grand. I never saw a temple all the time I was there, but the hill was the only real attraction for a kid. This was one very steep hill. And it's amazing as a kid what you can do with a hill if you're willing to risk life and limb. I remember I used to get my Buffalo Bill annual and put it on a roller skate, widthwise, and then sit on it and just zoom down Temple Hill. Too bad if anything was in the way. You had no brakes. And at the end, there was a road that you had to cross, which meant playing chicken with cars. Not that there were many cars. But I can't believe this hair-raising ride. I'd be sitting 2 inches or less off the ground, and God help the lady with the pram, I used to yell, "Look out! Pull over!" Never got stopped for doing it. You got away with things in those days. I have one deep scar from that period. The flagstones, big heavy ones, were laid out beside the road, loose, not yet bedded in concrete. And of course, thinking I was Superman, I just wanted, with a friend, to get one of them out of the way, because it was ruining our football game. Memory is fiction, and an alternative fiction of that event is from my friend and playmate Sandra Hall, consulted all these years later. She remembers that I offered gallantly to move the flagstone for her because the gap was too wide for her to leap between them. She also remembers much blood as the flagstone dropped and squashed my finger, and I raced to the sink indoors where it flowed and flowed. And then there were stitches. The result over the years, mustn't exaggerate, may well have affected my guitar playing because it really flattened out the finger for pick work. It could have something to do with the sound. I've got this extra grip. Also, when I'm finger-picking, gives me a bit more of a claw, because a chunk came out. So it's flat, and it's also more pointed, which comes in handy occasionally. And the nail never grew back again properly. It's sort of bent. It was a long way back and forth to school, and to avoid the steep gradient of Temple Hill, I'd walk round the back, right round the hill. It was called the Cinder Path, and it was level. But it meant walking around the back of the factories, past Burroughs Welcome and Bowater's Paper Mill, past an evil-smelling creek with all the green and yellow shit bubbling. Every chemical in the world had been poured into this creek, and it's steaming like hot sulfur springs. I held my breath and walked quicker. It really looked like something out of hell. At the front of the building, there was a garden and a beautiful pond, with swans floating about, which is where you learned about more front than Harrods. I kept a notebook for songs and ideas on the last tour we did while I was thinking about these memoirs. There's an entry that reads, "A snapshot of Bert and Doris leapfrogging in the 30s. I found in my gander bag. Tears to my eyes. The pictures actually show them doing a kind of calisthenics. Bert doing handstands on Doris's back, both of them doing cartwheels and tableau, Bert particularly showing off his physique. Bert and Doris seemed, in those early photographs, to be having a wonderful time together, going camping, going to the sea, having so many friends. He was a real athlete. He was an Eagle Scout, too, which is the highest you can get in scouting. He was a boxer, Irish boxer. Very physical, my dad. In that way, I think I've inherited that thing of, oh, come on, what do you mean you're not feeling well? The body, you take that for granted. Doesn't matter what you do to it. It's supposed to work. Forget about taking care of it. We have that constitution where it's unforgivable for it to break down. I've stuck to it. Ah, it's just a bullet, just a flesh wound. Doris and I were close, and Bert was excluded in a way, simply because he wasn't there half the time. Bert was a fucking hard-working man, silly sod for 20-odd quid a week, going up to Hammersmith to work for General Electric where he was a foreman. He knew a lot about valves, the loading and transporting of them. You can say what you like about Bert. He wasn't a man of ambition. I think because he grew up through the Depression, his idea of ambition was getting a job and holding on to it. He got up at 5, back home at 7:30, went to bed at 10:30, which gave him about 3 hours a day with me. He tried to make it up to me at weekends. I'd go to his tennis club with him, or he'd take me up the heath and we'd play soccer a bit, or we'd work our garden allotment. Do this, do that. All right, Dad. Wheelbarrow. Hoe this, weed this. I liked to watch the way things grow, and I knew my dad knew what he was on about. We've got to get these spuds in now. Just the basic stuff. Nice runner beans this year. He was pretty distant. There wasn't time to be close, but I was quite happy. To me, he was a great bloke. He was just me dad. Being an only child forces you to invent your world. First, you're living in a house with two adults, and so certain bits of childhood will go by with you listening almost exclusively to adult conversation. And hearing all these problems about the insurance and the rent, I've got nobody to turn to. But any only child will tell you that. You can't grab hold of a sister or a brother. You go out and make friends, but playtime stops when the sun goes down. And then the other side of that, with no brothers or sisters and no immediate cousins in the area, I've got loads of extended family, but they weren't there, was how to make friends and who to make friends with. It becomes a very important, a very vital part of existence when you're that age. Holidays were particularly intense from that point of view. We'd go to B Sands in Devon, where we used to have a caravan. It was next to a village called Hall Sands, which had fallen into the sea, a ruined village, which was very interesting to a young kid. It was really five-go-mad in Dorset, all these dilapidated houses, and half of them you can see under the water. These weird, romantic ruins right next door. B Sands was an old fishing village, right on the beach, where fishing boats pulled up. To me, when I was a kid, it was a great community, because you got to know everybody within 2 or 3 days. Within 4 days, I'm talking with a deep Devon burr and relishing being a local. I'd meet tourists. Which way's Kingbridge? Ooh, where you be going? Very Elizabethan turn of phrase, still talking very ancient English. Or we'd go camping with tents, which is what Bert and Doris had always done. How to light the primus. How to put the fly sheet up, the ground sheet down. I'm with just Mom and Dad, and when I get there, I'd look to see if there was anybody to hang with. And I'd get a bit wary if I was the only one. And I'd get a bit jealous sometimes when I saw a family with 4 brothers and 2 sisters. But at the same time, it makes you grow up, in that you're basically exposed to the adult world unless you create your own. The imagination comes into play then, and also things to do by yourself, like wanking. It was very intense when I did make friends. Sometimes I'd meet a great bunch of brothers or sisters in some other tent, and I'd always be heartbroken when it was over, gone. Their big thing, my parents, was Saturday and Sunday at the Bexley Tennis Club. It was an appendix to the Bexley Cricket Club. There was always this feeling at the tennis club, because of Bexley Cricket Club's magnificent and beautiful 19th century pavilion, that you were the poor cousin. You never got invited over to the cricket club. Unless it was pissing with rain, every weekend, that was it. Straight to the tennis club. I know more about Bexley than I do about Dartford. I would follow on the train after lunch with my cousin Kay and meet my parents there every weekend. Most of the other people there were definitely on another strata, English class-wise, at the time. They had cars. We went on bikes. My job was to pick up the balls that went over the railway line at the cost of nearly getting electrocuted. For companionship, I kept pets. I had a cat and a mouse. It's hard to believe that's what I had. It may explain a little of what I am. A little white mouse, Gladys. I would bring her to school and have a chat in the French lesson when it got boring. I'd feed her my dinner and lunch, and I'd come home with a pocket full of mouse shit. Mouse shit doesn't matter. It comes out in hardened pellets. There's no pong involved. It's not squidgy or anything like that. You just empty your pockets and out come these pellets. Gladys was true and trusted. She very rarely poked her head out of the pocket and exposed herself to instant death. But Doris had Gladys and my cat knocked off. She killed all my pets when I was a kid. She didn't like animals. She threatened to do it, and she did it. I put a note on her bedroom door with a drawing of a cat that said, "Murderer." I never forgave her for that. Doris's reaction was the usual. "Shut up. Don't be so soft. It was pissing all over the place." Doris's job when I was growing up, and almost from the time the machines were invented, was washing machine demonstrator. Specifically, a hot point specialist at the co-op in Dartford High Street. She was very good at this. She was an artist at demonstrating how they worked. Doris had wanted to be an actress, to be on the stage, to dance. It ran in the family. I'd go in and stand amongst the crowd circled around her, watch her demonstrate how fantastic the new hot point was. She didn't have one herself. It took her ages to get her own. But she could make a real show out of how to load a hot point. They didn't even have running water. You had to fill them and empty them with a bucket. They were new things in those days, and people would say, "I'd love a machine to wash my clothes, but Jesus, it's like rocket science to me." And my mom's job was to say, "No, it's not. It's this easy." And when later on we were living skint and nasty in the peeling refuse bin of Edith Grove before the stones took off, we always had clean clothes because Doris would demonstrate them, iron them, and send them back with her admirer, Bill, the taxi driver. Send them in the morning, back at night. Doris just needed dirty material. Can we provide, baby? Years later, Charlie Watts would spend day after day in Savile Row with his tailors, just feeling the quality, deciding which buttons to use. I couldn't go there at all. Something to do with my mother, I think. She was always going into drapery stores looking for curtains, and I had no say in it. I'd just be parked on a chair or bench or shelf or something, and I'd watch Mum. She's got what she wanted, and they're wrapping it up, and then, oh no. She suddenly turns around and sees something else she wants, pushing the man to the limit. At the cash and carry, the money went through those tubes in a little canister. I used to sit there watching for hours, while my mother decided what she couldn't afford to buy. But what can you say about the first woman in your life? She was Mum. She sorted me out. She fed me. She was forever slicking my hair and straightening my clothes in public. Humiliation. But it's Mum. I didn't realize until later that she was also my mate. She could make me laugh. There was music all the time, and I do miss her so. How my mum and dad got together is a miracle. Something so random, the random of opposites in their backgrounds and personalities. Bert's family were stern, rigid socialists. His father, my grandfather, Ernest G. Richards, known locally as Uncle Ernie, was not just a Labor Party stalwart. Ernie was up in arms for the working man, and when he started, there was no socialist movement. There was no Labor Party. Ernie and my grandmother, Eliza, were married in 1902, at the very beginning of the party. They had two MPs in 1900. And he won that part of London for Keir Hardie, the party's founder. He would hold that fort for Keir, come what may, day in, day out, canvassing and recruiting after the First World War. Walthamstow was fertile labor territory then. It had taken in a big working-class exodus from the East End of London, and a new rail commuter population, the political front line. Ernie was staunch in the real meaning of that word. No backing down, no retreat. Walthamstow became a labor stronghold, a safe enough seat for Clement Attlee, the first labor prime minister, who'd put Churchill out in 1945, and who was the MP for Walthamstow in the 1950s. He sent a message when Ernie died, calling him the salt of the earth, and they sang the Red Flag at his funeral, a song they have only just stopped singing at the Labour Party conferences. I'd never taken in the touchiness of the lyrics. Then raise the scarlet standard high. Within its shade, we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. And Ernie's job? He was a gardener, and he worked for the same food production firm for 35 years. But Eliza, my grandmother, was, if anything, saltier. She was elected a councillor before Ernie, and in 1941, she became the mayor of Walthamstow. Like Ernie, she had risen through the political hierarchy. Her origins were Bermondsey working class, and she more or less invented child welfare for Walthamstow, a real reformer. She must have been a piece of work. She became chairman of the housing committee in a borough that had one of the biggest programs of council house expansion in the country. Doris always complained that Eliza was so upright, she wouldn't let her and Bert have a council house when they were first married. Wouldn't push them up the list. I can't give you a house. You're my daughter-in-law. Not just strict, but rigid. So it's always intrigued me. The unlikelihood of somebody from that family getting together with this other lot of libertines. Doris and her six sisters, I come from a matriarchy on both sides of my family, grew up in two bedrooms, one for them and another for my grandparents, Gus and Emma, in Islington. That's tight accommodation. One front room that was only used on holidays, and a kitchen and parlor in the back. The whole family in those rooms and that small kitchen, another family living upstairs. My grandfather Gus, God bless him. I owe so much of my love of music to him. I send him notes frequently and pin them up. Thanks, Granddad. Theodore Augustus Dupree, the patriarch of this family, surrounded by women, lived near Seven Sisters Road, with seven daughters, at 13 Crosley Street, N7. And he'd say, it's not just the seven daughters. With the wife, that makes eight. His wife Emma, my long-suffering grandmother, whose maiden name was Turner, and who was a very good piano player. Emma was really a step above Gus, very ladylike, spoke French. How he got his hands on her, I don't know. They met on a Ferris wheel at the agricultural fair in Islington. Gus was a looker, and he always had a gag. He could always laugh. He used that humor, that habit of laughing, to keep everything alive and going in dire times. Many of his generation were like that. Doris certainly inherited his insane sense of humor, as well as his musicality. We're supposed not to know where Gus came from, but then none of us know where we come from. The pits of hell, maybe. Family rumor is that that elaborate name wasn't his real name. For some weird reason, none of us ever bothered to find out. But there it is, on the census form. Theodore Dupree, born in 1892 from a large family in Hackney, one of 11 children. His father is listed as paper hanger, born in Southwark. Dupree is a Huguenot name, and many of those came originally from the Channel Islands, Protestant refugees from France. Gus had left school at 13, and trained and worked as a pastry cook around Islington, and learned to play violin from one of his father's friends in Camden Passage. He was an all-around musician. He had a dance band in the 30s. He played saxophone then, but he claimed he got gassed in the First World War and couldn't blow afterwards. But I don't know. There are so many stories. Gus managed to cover himself in cobwebs and mists. Bert said he was in the catering detachment from his trade as a pastry cook, and he wasn't in the front line. He was just baking bread. And Bert said to me, if he got gassed, it was in his own oven. But my Aunt Marge, who knows everything and still lives as this is written, age 90-something, says that Gus was called up in 1916 and was a sniper in World War I. She said that whenever he talked about the war, he always had tears in his eyes. Didn't want to kill anybody. He was wounded in the leg and shoulder, either at Passchendaele or the Somme. When he couldn't play the saxophone, he took up the violin again and the guitar. His wound aggravated his bowing arm, and a tribunal awarded him 10 shillings a week for the wounding. Gus was a close friend of Buddy Howe's, who was a famous musical star of the 1930s. They were in the war together, and they did a double act in the officers' mess and cooked for them, so they had a better chance to feed themselves than the average soldier. So says Auntie Margie. By the 1950s, he had a square dance band, Gus Dupree and his boys, and used to do well playing the American air bases, playing hoedowns. He'd work in a factory in Islington in the day and play at night, getting up in a white-fronted shirt, a dickie. He played Jewish weddings and Masonic dues, and he brought cakes back in his violin case. All my aunts remember that. He must have been very hard up. He never, for example, bought new clothes, only second-hand clothes and shoes. Why was my grandmother long-suffering, apart from being in various states of pregnancy for 23 years? Gus's great delight was to play violin while Emma played piano. But during the war, she caught him bonking an ARP warden in a blackout. Caught him up to the usual, on the piano too, even worse. And she never played piano for him again. That was the price. And she was very stubborn. In fact, she was very unlike Gus. Not attuned to his artist's temperament. So he roped his daughters in. But it was never quite the same, Keith, he would tell me. Never quite the same. With the stories he told me, you'd think Emma was Arthur Rubinstein. There was nothing like Emma. She could play, he'd say. He turned it into a long-lost love, a yearning. Unfortunately, that hadn't been his only infidelity. There were lots of little rumpuses and walkouts. Gus was a ladies' man, and Emma just got fed up. The fact is that Gus and his family were a very rare thing for those days. They were about as bohemian as you could get. Gus encouraged a kind of irreverence and nonconformity, but it was in the genes, too. One of my aunts was in repertory, into amateur dramatics. They were all artistically inclined in one way or another, depending on their circumstances. Given the times we're talking about, this was a very free family, very un-Victorian. Gus was the kind of guy that, when his daughters were growing up, and they'd be called on by four or five of their boyfriends, and their boyfriends would be sitting down on the sofa opposite the window, and the girls would be sitting across from them, would go up to the John and unload a piece of string with a used rubber on it and dangle it in front of the boys, and the girls couldn't see it. That was his sense of humor. And all the boys would be going red and cracking up, and the girls wouldn't know what the hell for. Gus liked to make a little commotion, and Doris said how horrified her mother, Emma, was by the scandal that two of Gus's sisters, Henrietta and Felicia, who lived together in Colebrook Row, were, she would say it in a whisper, on the game. Not all Doris's sisters were like her, with such a spicy tongue, you might say. Some of them were upright and proper like Emma, but no one denied the fact of Henrietta and Felicia. My earliest memories of Gus were the walks we took, the sorties we made. Mostly, I think, for him, to get out of the house of women. I was an excuse, and so was the dog, called Mr. Thompson Woofed. Gus had never had a boy in the house, son or grandchild, until I came along. And I think this was a big moment, a big opportunity to go for walks and disappear. When Emma wanted him to do household chores, he invariably replied, "I'd love to, Em, but I've got a hole in my bum." A nod and a wink, and I'd take the dog for a walk. And we'd go for miles, and sometimes, it seemed, for days. Once on Primrose Hill, we went to look at the stars, with Mr. Thompson, of course. "Don't know if we can make it home tonight," said Gus. So we slept under a tree. "Let's take the dog for a walk." That was the code for "we're moving." "All right. Bring your Mac. It's not raining. Bring your Mac." Gus once asked me, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, while out for a stroll, "Have you got a penny on you?" "Yeah, Gus." "See that kid on the corner?" "Yeah, Gus." "Go give it to him." "What, Gus?" "Go on. He's harder up than you." I give the penny. Gus gives me 2 back. The lesson stuck. Gus never bored me. On New Cross Station late at night in deep fog, Gus gave me my first dog end to smoke. No one will see. A familiar gussism was to greet a friend with, "Hello, don't be a cunt all your life." The delivery so beautifully flat, so utterly familiar, I loved the man. A cuff round the head. "You never heard that. What, Gus?" He would hum entire symphonies as we walked, sometimes to Primrose Hill, Highgate, or down Islington through the archway. The Angel, every fucking where. "Fancy a Savaloy?" "Here, Gus." "You can't have one. We're going to Lion's Corner House." "Here, Gus." "Don't tell your grandmother." "Okay, Gus, what about the dog?" He knows the chef. His warmth, his affection surrounded me. His humor kept me doubled up for large portions of the day. It was hard to find much that was funny in those days in London, but there was always music. "Just pop in here. I've got to get some strings." "Okay, Gus." I didn't say a lot. I listened. Him with his cheese cutter, me with my Mac. Maybe from him I got the wanderlust. If you've got 7 daughters off the 7 Sisters Road, and with the wife it makes 8, you get out and about. He never drank, that I can recall, but he must have done something. We never hit pubs, but he would disappear into the back rooms of shops quite frequently. I perused the merchandise with glowing eyes. He'd come out with the same. "Let's go. Got the dog?" "Yeah, Gus." "Come along, Mr. Thompson." You had no idea where you'd end up. Little shops around the Angel in Islington. He'd just disappear into the back. "Just stay here a minute, son, hold the dog." And then he'd come out saying, "Okay." And we'd go on and end up in the West End in the workshops of the big music stores, like Ivor Merrance and HMV. He knew all the makers, the repair guys there. He'd sit me up on a shelf. There'd be these vats of glue and instruments hung up and strung up. Guys in long brown coats, gluing. And then there'd be somebody at the end, testing instruments. There'd be some music going on. And then there'd be these little harried men coming in from the orchestra pit saying, "Have you got my violin?" I'd just sit up there with a cup of tea, with a biscuit, and the vats of glue going blub, blub, blub like a mini Yellowstone Park. And I was just fascinated. I never got bored. Violins and guitars hung up on wires, and going around on a conveyor belt, and all these guys fixing and making and refurbishing instruments. I see it back then as very alchemical, like Disney's The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I just fell in love with instruments. Gus was leading me subtly into getting interested in playing, rather than shoving something into my hand and saying, "It goes like this." The guitar was totally out of reach. It was something you looked at, thought about, but never got your hands on. I'll never forget the guitar on top of his upright piano every time I'd go and visit, starting maybe from the age of 5. I thought that was where the thing lived. I thought it was always there, and I just kept looking at it. And he didn't say anything, and a few years later, I was still looking at it. "Hey, when you get tall enough, you can have a go at it," he said. I didn't find out until after he was dead that he only brought that out and put it up there when he knew I was coming to visit. So I was being teased in a way. I think he studied me because he heard me singing. When songs came on the radio, we'd all start harmonizing. That's just what we did. A load of singers. I can't remember when it was that he took the guitar down and said, "Here you go." Maybe I was 9 or 10, so I started pretty late. A gut-string classical Spanish guitar. A sweet, lovely little lady. Although I didn't know what the hell to do with it, the smell of it, even now, to open a guitar case, when it's an old wooden guitar, I could crawl in and close the lid. Gus wasn't much of a guitar player himself, but he knew the basics. He showed me the first licks and chords, the major chord shapes, D, G, and E. He said, "Play Malagueña, you can play anything." By the time he said, "I think you're getting the hang of it," I was pretty happy. My 6 aunts, in no special order, Marge, Beatrice, Joanna, Elsie, Connie, Patty, amazingly, at the time of writing, 5 of them are still alive. My favorite aunt was Joanna, who died in the 1980s of multiple sclerosis. She was my mate. She was an actress. A rush of glamour came into the room when Joanna arrived. Black hair, wearing bangles and smelling of perfume. Especially when everything else was so drab in the early 50s. Joanna would come in, and it was as if the Ronettes had arrived. She used to do Chekhov and stuff like that at Highbury Theater. She was also the only one that never married. She always had boyfriends, and she too, like all of us, was into music. We would harmonize together. Any song that came on the radio, we'd say, "Let's try that." I remember singing "When Will I Be Loved," the Everly Brothers song with her. The move to Spielman Road on Temple Hill, across the tracks and into the wasteland, was a catastrophe for me for at least a whole year of living dangerously and fearfully when I was 9 or 10. I was a very small guy in those days. I grew into my rightful size, not until I was 15 or so. If you're a squirt like I was, you're always on the defensive. Also, I was a year younger than everybody else in my class, because of my birthday, December 18th. I was unfortunate in that respect. And a year at that age is enormous. I loved to play football, actually. I was a good left winger. I was swift, and I tried to shoot my passes. But I'm the smallest fucker, right? One bang into a back and I'm down in the mud. A solid tackle from a guy that's a year older than me. If you're that small and they're that tall, you're a football yourself. You're always going to be a squirt. So it was, "Oh, hello, little Richards." I was called Monkey because my ears stuck out. Everybody was called something. The route to my school from Temple Hill was the street without joy. Up to the age of 11, I'd bus it there and walk it back. Why didn't I bus it back? No fucking money. I'd spent the bus fare, spent the haircutting money, done it myself in front of the mirror. Snip, snip, snip. So I had to make my way across town, totally the opposite side of town. About a 40-minute walk. And there's only two ways to go. Havelock Road or Prince's Road. Toss a coin. But then I knew that the minute I got out of school, this guy would be waiting for me. The guy always guessed which way I was going. I'd try to figure out new routes, get busted in people's gardens. I'd spend the whole day wondering how to get home without taking a beating, which is hard work, 5 days a week. Sometimes it didn't happen, but at the same time you're sitting in the classroom churning inside. How the hell do I get past this guy? This guy would be merciless. There was nothing I could do about it, and I would live in fear all day, which ruined my concentration. When I got a black eye from being beaten up, I'd go home to Doris, and she'd say, "Where did you get that from?" "Oh, I fell over." Otherwise, you'd get the old lady wound up about, "Who did it?" It was better to say you fell off your bike. Meanwhile, I'm getting these terrible school reports, and Bert's looking at me. "What's going on?" You can't explain that you spend the whole day at school worrying how to get home. You can't do that. Wimps do that. It's something you gotta figure out for yourself. The actual beating was not the problem. I learned how to take beatings. I didn't really get that hurt. You learn how to keep your guard up, and you learn how to make sure that somebody thinks they've done far more damage to you than they really have. Ah! And they think, "Oh my God, I've really done some harm." And then I wised up. I wish I'd thought of it sooner. There was this very nice bloke, and I can't remember his name now. He was a bit of an oaf. He wasn't made for the academic life, let's put it like that. And he was big, and he lived on the estate. And he was so worried about his homework, I said, "Look, I'll do your fucking homework, but you come home with me. It's not that far out of your way." So for the price of doing his history and geography, suddenly I had this minder. I always remember the first time, a couple of guys waiting for me as usual, and they saw him coming, and we beat the shit out of them. It only took 2 or 3 times, and a little ritual bloodletting, and victory was ours. It wasn't until I got to my next school, Dartford Tech, that things, by a great fluke, righted themselves. By the time of the 11-plus exam, Mick had already gone to Dartford Grammar School, which is, ooh, the ones in the red uniforms. And the year after that was my turn, and I failed miserably. but not miserably enough to go to what was then known as secondary modern. It's all changed now, but if you went there under that archaic system, you were lucky if you got a factory job at the end. You were not going to be trained for anything more than manual labor. The teachers were terrible, and their only function was to keep this mob in line. I got into that middle ground of technical school, which is, in retrospect, a very nebulous phrase. It means you didn't make grammar. But there's something worthwhile in there. You realize later on that you're being graded and sifted by this totally arbitrary system that rarely, if ever, takes into account your whole character. Or, well, he might not be very good in class, but he knows more about drawing. They never took into account that, hey, you might be bored because you know that already. The playground's the big judge. That's where all decisions are really made between your peers. It's called play, but it's nearer to a battlefield, and it can be brutal, the pressure. There's two blokes kicking the shit out of some poor little bugger and, oh, they're just letting off steam. In those days, it was pretty physical at times, but most of it was just taunts, pansy and all of that. It took me a long time to figure out how to knock somebody else out instead of me getting it. I'd been an expert at taking beatings for quite a long time. Then I had a lucky break, where I did a bully in by total sheer luck. It was one of those magical moments. I was 12 or 13. 1 minute on the mark, and with just one swift move, I put the big man in school down. Against the rockery in the little flower bed, he slipped and fell over, and I was on him. When I fight, a red curtain comes down. I don't see a thing, but I know where to go. It's as if a red veil drops over my eyes. No mercy, mate. The boot went in. Pulled off by the prefects and all of that. How the mighty are fallen. I can still remember the astounding surprise when this guy went down. I can still see the little rockery and the pansies he fell over in. And after that, I didn't let him up. Once he was down, the whole atmosphere in the schoolyard changed. A huge cloud seemed to be lifted from me. My reputation after that suddenly released me from all that angst and stress. I'd never been aware the cloud was so large. It was the only time I started to feel good about school, mostly because I was able to repay a few favors some other guys had done for me. An ugly little sod called Stephen Yard, Boots we used to call him, because of his huge feet, was the favorite to be picked on by the bully boys. He was being taunted all the time. And knowing what it was like to be waiting for a beating, I stood up for him. I became his minder. It was, don't fuck with Stephen Yard. I never wanted to get big enough to beat up other people. I just wanted to get big enough to stop it happening. With that weight off my mind, my work improved at Dartford Tech. I was even getting praise. Doris kept some of my reports. Geography, 59%, a good exam result. History, 63%, quite good work. But against the science subjects on the report sheet, the form master put a single bracket that enclosed them all. There was no daylight between them for abjectness. And he wrote them all off with no improvement in mathematics, physics, and chemistry. Engineering drawing was still rather beyond him. That report on science subjects contained the story of the big betrayal and of how I was turned from a reasonably compliant student into a school terrorist and a criminal with a lively and lasting rage against authority. There's a photograph of our group of schoolboys standing in front of a bus, smiling for the camera, in the company of one schoolmaster. I am standing in the front row, wearing shorts, aged 11. It was taken in 1955 in London, where we had gone to sing at a concert at St. Margaret's Church in Westminster Abbey. A choir competition between schools, performed in front of the Queen. Our school choir had come a long way. A bunch of Dartford yokels who were winning cups and prizes for choral work on a national level. The three sopranos were Terry and Spike and me. The stars, you might say, of the show. And our choir master, pictured by the bus, the genius who had forged this little flying unit out of such unpromising material, was called Jake Clare. He was a mystery man, I found out only many years later that he'd been an Oxford choir master, one of the best in the country. But he was exiled or degraded for boinky boink with little boys. Given another chance in the colonies. I don't want to sully his name, and I have to say, this is only what I heard. He'd certainly had better material to work with than us. What was he doing down here? Around us, anyway, he kept his hands clean, although he was famed for playing with himself through his trouser pocket. He hammered us into shape to the point where we were clearly one of the best choirs in the country, and he picked out the three best sopranos that he was given. We won quite a few trophies, which hung in the assembly hall. I've still never played a better gig prestige-wise than Westminster Abbey. You got the taunts. Oh, choir boy, are we? Fancy pantsy. Didn't bother me. The choir was wonderful. You got coach trips to London. You got out of physics and chemistry, and I would have done anything for that. That's where I learned a lot about singing and music and working with musicians. I learned how to put a band together. It's basically the same job, and how to keep it together. And then the shit hit the fan. Your voice breaks, age 13, and Jake Clare gave the three of us sopranos the pink slip. But they also demoted us, kept us down one class. We had to stay down a year because we hadn't got physics and chemistry and hadn't done our maths. Yeah, but you let us off because of choir practice. We worked our butts off. That was a rough thank you. The Great Depression came right after that. Suddenly, at 13, I had to sit down and start again with the year under. Redo a whole school year. This was the kick in the guts, pure and unmixed. The moment that happened, Spike, Terry, and I, we became terrorists. I was so mad I had a burning desire for revenge. I had reason then to bring down this country and everything it stood for. I spent the next 3 years trying to fuck them up. If you want to breed a rebel, that's the way to do it. No more haircuts, two pairs of trousers, the skin-tight ones under the regulation flannels, which came off the minute I was out of the gate. Anything to annoy them. Didn't get me anywhere. Got me a lot of black looks from my dad, but even that didn't stop me. I really didn't like to disappoint my dad, but sorry, Dad. It still rankles, that humiliation. It still hasn't gone out, the fire. That's when I started to look at the world in a different way. Not their way anymore. That's when I realized that there's bigger bullies than just bullies. There's them, the authorities. And a slow-burning fuse was lit. I could have got expelled easily after that, in any different way. But then I'd have to face my dad. And he would have spotted that immediately, that I'd manipulated it. So it had to be a slow-moving campaign. I just lost total interest in authority or trying to make good under their terms. School reports? Give me a bad one. I'll forge it. I got very good at forgery. He could do better. Somehow I managed to find the same ink, make it. He could not do better. My dad would look at it. He could not do better. Why does he give you a B-? Pushing my luck a bit there. But they never detected the forgeries. I was actually hoping they would, because then I could be done, expelled for forgery. But apparently it was too good, or they decided that that one is not going to work, boy. I lost total interest in school after choir went down the tube. Technical drawing, physics, mathematics, a yawn. Because it didn't matter how much they tried to teach me algebra, I just don't get it. And I don't see why I should. I'll understand at gunpoint, on bread and water and a whip. I would learn it, I could learn it, but there's something inside of me saying, this is going to be of no help to you. And if you do want to learn it, you'll learn it by yourself. At first, after the voice broke, and we were given that boot down, I stuck very close together with the guys I used to sing with, because we all felt the same burning resentment for winning them all the medals and shields that they were always so proud of in their assembly hall. Meanwhile, we're cleaning their bloody shoes round the back, and that's the thanks you get. You cut some rebel style. In the high street, there was Leonard's, where they sold very cheap jeans, just as jeans were becoming jeans. and they would sell fluorescent socks around 56, 57. Rock and roll socks that glow in the dark, so she always knows where I am, with black musical notes on them, pink and green. Used to have a pair of each. More daring still, I'd have pink on one foot and green on the other. That was really like, wow. DiMascio's was the ice cream parlor, coffee shop. Old DiMascio's son went to school with us, big fat Italian boy. But he could always make plenty of friends by bringing them down to his dad's joint. There was a jukebox there, so it was a hang. Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard, apart from a load of schlock. It was the one bit of Americana in Dartford. Just a little store, counter down the left side, jukebox, some seats and tables, the ice cream machine. At least once a week, I went to the cinema, and usually to the Saturday morning pictures, either at the Gem or the Granada, like Captain Marvel, Shazam. If you said it right, it might actually happen. Me and my mates in the middle of the field going, Shazam! We're not saying it right. Other blokes laughing behind our heads. Yeah, you're not gonna laugh when I get it right. Shazam! Flash Gordon. Those little puffs of smoke. He had bleach blonde hair. Captain Marvel. You could never remember what it was about. It was more about the transformation. About just a regular guy who says one word, and suddenly he's gone. I want to get that down, you'd think. I want to get out of this place. And as we got bigger and a little brawnier, we started to swing our weight about a bit. The ludicrous side to Dartford Tech was its pretensions to being a public school. That's what they call private schools in England. The prefects had little gold tassels on their caps. There was East House and West House. It was trying to recapture a lost world, as if the war hadn't happened, of cricket, cups and prizes, schoolboy glory. All of the masters were totally substandard, but they were still aiming for this ideal, as if it were Eton or Winchester, as if it were the 20s or the 30s or even the 1890s. In the midst of this, there was, in my middle years there, soon after the catastrophe, a period of anarchy, that seemed to go on for a very long time. A prolonged period of chaos. Maybe it was just one term in which, for whatever reason, these mad mass bundles would go on in the playing fields. There were about 300 of us, everybody leaping around. It is strange thinking back that nobody stopped us. There were probably just too many of us running about, and nobody got hurt. But it allowed a certain degree of anarchy to the point that when the head prefect did come along and try to stop us one day, he was set upon and lynched. He was one of those perennial martinets, captain of sport, head of school, the most brilliant at all things. He swung his weight around. He would be really nasty to the younger kids. And we decided to give him a taste. His name was Swanton. I remember him well. And it was raining. Very nasty weather, and we stripped him and then chased him until he climbed a tree. We left him with his hat with the little gold tassels. That's all he had left on. Swanton came down from the tree and rose to become a professor of medieval studies at the University of Exeter and wrote a key work called English Poetry Before Chaucer. Of all the schoolmasters, the one sympathetic one who didn't bark out orders was the religious instruction teacher. He used to wear a powder blue suit with cum stains down the leg. Mr. Etheridge, the wanker. Religious instruction, 45 minutes. Let's turn to Luke. And we were saying, either he's pissed himself, or he's just been round the back shagging Mrs. Mountjoy, who was the art mistress. I had adopted a criminal mind. Anything to fuck them up. We won cross-country 3 times, but we never ran it. We'd start off, go and have a smoke for an hour or so, and then chip in towards the end. And the 3rd or 4th time, they got wise and put monitors down the whole trail, and we weren't spotted along the other 7 miles. He has maintained a low standard, was the 6-word summary of my 1959 school report, suggesting correctly that I had put some effort into the enterprise. I was taking in a lot of music then, without really knowing it. England was often under fog, but there was a fog of words that settled between people too. One didn't show emotions. One didn't actually talk much at all. The talk was all around things, codes and euphemisms. Some things couldn't be said or even alluded to. It was a residue of the Victorians, and all that brilliantly portrayed in those black and white movies of the early 60s. Saturday night and Sunday morning, this sporting life. And life was black and white. The Technicolor was just around the corner, but it wasn't there yet in 1959. People really do want to touch each other, to the heart. That's why you have music. If you can't say it, sing it. Listen to the songs of the period, heavily pointed and romantic, and trying to say things that they couldn't say in prose or even on paper. Weather's fine, 7:30 p.m., wind has died down. P.S., I love you. Doris was different. She was musical, like Gus. At 3 or 4 or 5 years old, at the end of the war, I was listening to Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Big Bill Brunzi, Louis Armstrong. It just spoke to me. It was what I listened to every day because my mom played it. My ears would have gone there anyway, but my mom trained them to go to the black side of town without her even knowing it. I didn't know whether the singers were white, black, or green at the time, but after a while, if you've got some musical ears, you pick up on the difference between Pat Boone's Ain't That a Shame and Fats Domino's Ain't That a Shame. Not that Pat Boone's was particularly bad. He was a very good singer. But it was just so shallow and produced. And Fats's was just so natural. Doris liked Gus's music, too. He used to tell her to listen to Stefan Grappelli, Django Reinhardt's Hot Club, that lovely swing guitar, and Bix Beiderbecke. She liked jazzy swing. Later on, she loved going to hear Charlie Watts's band at Ronnie Scott's. We didn't have a record player for a long time, and most of it for us was on the radio, mostly on the BBC, my mother being a master twiddler of the knobs. There were some great British players, some of the Northern Dance Orchestras and all those that were on the variety shows, some great players, no slouches. If there was anything good, she'd find it. So I grew up with this searching for music. She'd point out who was good or bad, even to me. She was musical, musical. There were voices she would hear and she'd say, "Screecher," when everyone else would think it was a great soprano. This was pre-TV. I grew up listening to really good music, including a little bit of Mozart and Bach in the background, which I found very over my head at the time, but I soaked it up. I was basically a musical sponge, and I was just fascinated by watching people play music. If they were in the street, I'd gravitate towards it. A piano player in the pub, whatever it was. My ears were picking it up, note for note. Didn't matter if it was out of tune. There were notes happening. There were rhythms and harmonies. And they would start zooming around in my ears. It was very like a drug. In fact, a far bigger drug than smack. I could kick smack. I couldn't kick music. One note leads to another, and you never know quite what's going to come next, and you don't want to. It's like walking on a beautiful tightrope. I think the first record I bought was Little Richard's Long Tall Sally. Fantastic record, even to this day. Good records just get better with age. But the one that really turned me on, like an explosion one night, listening to Radio Luxembourg on my little radio when I was supposed to be in bed and asleep, was Heartbreak Hotel. That was the stunner. I'd never heard it before, or anything like it. I'd never heard of Elvis before. It was almost as if I'd been waiting for it to happen. When I woke up the next day, I was a different guy. Suddenly, I was getting overwhelmed. Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, Little Richard, Fats. Radio Luxembourg was notoriously difficult to keep on station. I had a little aerial and walked around the room, holding the radio up to my ear and twisting the aerial. trying to keep it down, because I'd wake Mum and Dad up. If I could get the signal right, I could take the radio under the blankets on the bed and keep the aerial outside and twist it there. I'm supposed to be asleep. I'm supposed to be going to school in the morning. Loads of ads for James Walker, the jewelers in every high street, and the Irish sweepstakes, with which Radio Lux had some deal. The signal was perfect for the ads. And now we have Fats Domino, Blueberry Hill, and shit. Then it would fade. Then, since my baby left me, it was just the sound. It was the last trigger. That was the first rock and roll I heard. It was a totally different way of delivering a song. A totally different sound. Stripped down, burnt, no bullshit, no violins and ladies' choruses and schmaltz. Totally different. It was bare, right to the roots, that you had a feeling were there, but hadn't yet heard. I've got to take my hat off to Elvis for that. The silence is your canvas. That's your frame. That's what you work on. Don't try and deafen it out. That's what Heartbreak Hotel did to me. It was the first time I'd heard something so stark. Then I had to go back to what this cat had done before. Luckily, I caught his name. The Radio Luxembourg signal came back in. That was Elvis Presley with Heartbreak Hotel. Shit. Around 1959, when I was 15, Doris bought me my first guitar. I was already playing when I could get one. But you can only tinker when you haven't got one of your own. It was a Rossetti. And it was about 15 quid. Doris didn't have the credit to buy it on higher purchase, so she got someone else to do it. And he defaulted on the payment. Big kerfuffle. It was a huge amount of money for her and Bert. But Gus must have had something to do with it, too. It was a gut string job. I started where every good guitar player should start. Down there on acoustic. On gut strings. You can get to wire later on. Anyway, I couldn't afford an electric. But I found just playing that Spanish, an old workman, and starting from there, it gave me something to build on. And then you get to steel strings, and then finally, wow, electricity. I mean, probably, if I had been born a few years later, I would have leapt on the electric guitar. But if you want to get to the top, you've got to start at the bottom. Same with anything. Same with running a whorehouse. I have my sketchbook and notebook of that year. The date is more or less 1959, the crucial year when I was mostly 15 years old. It's a neat, obsessive piece of work in blue biro. The pages are divided by columns and headings, and page 2, after a crucial page about Boy Scouting, of which more later, is called Record List 45 RPM. The first entry, title, Peggy Sue Got Married, artist, Buddy Holly and the Crickets. Underneath that, in a less neat scrawl, are the encircled names of girls. Mary, crossed out, Jenny, ticked, Janet, Marilyn, Veronica, and so on. Long players are The Buddy Holly Story, A Date with Elvis, Wild About Marty, Marty Wild, of course, for those who don't know, The Chirping Crickets. The lists include the usuals, Ricky Nelson, Eddie Cochran, Everly Brothers, Cliff Richard, Traveling.